Audrey Betcher, just wanted to get a quick count of who would be attending the event this Friday, right?
Bridal to Career Summit. If there's anybody who hasn't signed up who wants to, I just need to make sure. I want to get you on the list so there's enough food. So, okay?
So
I'm not sure yet.
Yeah, sure. Okay. But anybody who wants to just email me and I'll. Yeah, it's a muffin and a bottle of wine. Don't get it.
All right.
But it should be a really good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, the comprehensive plan update. Missy, you want to lead on?
Drum roll.
I have bad news and good news. Which one do you want first?
Bad.
Date.
All right. Bad news is it's just me today. The good news is that Charlie's plane got grounded just before takeoff because they had mechanical problems. So he's still in Indianapolis.
It's not a bad thing.
They had to be towed off the tarmac.
Oh, my goodness.
Better than the malfunction of flight. it's not bad.
Oh, that's how they take people off the plane.
That's called seeing the bright side.
Yeah. Good news is that they didn't take off. It's great news. So this has been a long-awaited update. A few weeks ago, you did receive an email from me identifying that the one of the plan was out on the internet. It's still in draft form, but it's ready for some review. Meeting with them next week, or no, 2 weeks, to go over some of the same material with them. Again, along the way, there are three main sections to the plan. The first section is the overarching goals and objectives, which is what is out there right now. The second section is really a deeper dive on integrated land use and transportation issues and policies. And the fourth section is really for delivery. The intent was to have Charlie here for both of these. Today, and he'll probably do the deeper dive on some of the transportation and land use pieces then in 2 weeks. So today we'll cover what a comprehensive plan is, the forces that are shaping our community and our changes that we need to prepare for, and how we're framing up that future vision. And this was done with a considerable amount of community input as well as technical evaluation. We'll just introduce translating that vision into policy today with some of the maps and some of the things that I think we're most anxious to see come toward the end of the presentation. And then we'll really get into some of the action steps and strategies of the next meeting. So, what is a comprehensive plan? Well, it is a planning a tool that is delegated to communities through statute. Gives the communities the authority to plan, to grant the power to prepare, adopt, and implement plans. Really, it's to help define an urban growth area, to guide future land use, and identify actions to promote public health, safety, and welfare. It's a framework that others can use to plan in harmony with city vision, community departments, as well as private sector investors. The plan provides an opportunity to consider the big picture, and how different geographies and community systems interrelate. It's an opportunity to consider future implications for today's decisions, to develop policies to guide actions and strategies around development policy, and to be strategic with the implementation and the limited resources that we have. It's a tool for prioritizing public investments and facilities to serve the plan's objectives. It is part of a suite of plans. The city's comprehensive plan is made up of a number of different plans. There are other plans that are not adopted as part of the overarching document, but they are still plans for the community to follow nonetheless, and again, help guide other departments in their implementation priorities. I want to just touch a little bit on what a plan is and what it isn't, and kind of dispel some of the myth around what a plan and a zoning policy are. The plan is not a zoning map. It's not a zoning ordinance. It provides a generalized view of just within general categories that comes into the zoning ordinance. It's not a regulatory document in the same way the zoning ordinance is. It will not necessarily correspond to how land is used today. It's a vision for the future. It's intended to provide a level of predictability as to the use of the pattern, but should not be construed as prescriptive solution. It's meant to guide, not define, the public investments. It may guide and include recommendations of how to get to the future that is envisioned in this plan. Well, it will include strategies for how we can get there. It provides a basis for planning and serving and creating the public facilities. There are some fixed assumptions that we used in developing this plan. Some of the plans that you've seen when recently, and I'll just call it the sanitary sewer ultimate service area map, is really, it's a plan that extends far beyond 2040. We are planning up to 2040 and 2045, roughly, with this plan. In that time horizon, an assumption was made that the sewage treatment plant capacity will not be expanded. The DMC EDA vision would basically come to fruition. And we do not consider major capacity improvements on 52, 63, or 14 consistent in that's investment plans and the projected needs. Downtown street capacity and space is fixed. That's an overarching issue that needs solutions. And we do not consider autonomous vehicles to be a major influence outside of specialized applications at this point. Future plan updates may need to modify. Forces and factors that shape the plan include growth factors such as employment, population, households, demographic changes that are driving changes in the markets, economic forces driving the change in types of employment and business models, emerging trends in real estate, residential tastes are changing, housing affordability concerns, evolving mobility options and access, natural features, and protection of natural features for use and enjoyment and for environmental protection. And the public assets, really balancing investments in preservation versus growth. The plan projects within the time horizon of this plan, we'll have roughly 50,000 new jobs, 50,000 more residents, and what's not on here is roughly 23,000 more households. Put this growth in context to our past, the previous 55 years included about 56,000 population growth. The upcoming 20 to 25 years will include 50,000. It's a much much more escalated scale of growth that we have to accommodate, and it's going to shift pressures on the community, and especially on your public facilities and your staff. Some of the key demographic changes that are affecting housing demand relate to where we have the biggest growth in our population. And we have the largest growth in population in households, of single-person households, and households over 65. And just to point out, if you could look over here on the right side of the screen, people living alone are accounting for, we expect about 58% of the growth. People living alone over 65, about 136% of the future growth. Married couples with related children, 7%. This might speak to some of the trends we're seeing in elevated interest in multifamily housing, smaller households, and more compact homes. Another way to look at this is, what are our current conditions in different types of housing? What are our expected future conditions? But really, where is that growth that we're expecting? In the detached housing styles, historically, those have outpaced attached 2-to-1, roughly, and that's flipping. We anticipate the attached style of housing, which includes apartments, to be 2-to-1 to the detached housing. Some other things Administration of Downtown Employment. I think most of you have seen this slide on the right numerous times, but we have a really unique situation in terms of the amount of commuters that come into our downtown each day and the volume of visitors that we have on an annual basis. Those are populations that are not accounted for in our census population, but those are populations that escalate usually Monday through Friday that we have to accommodate. And that shows up when we look at commuter projections. 20-something years ago, we had roughly 19,000 commuters, or roughly about 32,000 now. We expect to get to 52,000. We all know that Rochester is a major economic hub for all of Southeast Minnesota, and we have a major employer here that we anticipate will continue to grow. If you look at the far right column, you'll start to see some shifts also in other non-residential growth sectors in terms of the amount of anticipated growth in retail and office space, medical services, and industrial and so forth. So we have worked with the Southeast Minnesota Association of Realtors and did a survey locally. Statistically significant one, and one of the questions asked is, what kind of neighborhood would you prefer to live in? Community A is a neighborhood that has a mix of houses and stores and other businesses that are easy to walk to, and B is a neighborhood with really only houses that you have to drive to stores and other businesses. And our community is fairly split on that, but right now our market opportunities or our market choices are not very split. It's more heavily providing for Community B and less so in Community A. So there's some makeup work to do there to respond. Housing and shelter. When we think about housing affordability, this plan really takes into account total cost of living and not simply the cost of households, because the cost of transportation is a significant factor in the total cost of living for households. The graphic on the right is actually one that was prepared by Federal Highway Administration, demonstrating that locations in which people have less dependence on an automobile frees up resources in households. It removes strain. It provides opportunities for people to put their resources in other places that are in higher need. We know that our downtown is in need of some new transportation solutions, and you all know that we're in the midst of studying a number of elements related to that, but we need to achieve mode shift goals. We need to shift the volume of people currently driving alone to the downtown. As we have growth in traffic, we're also attempting to reduce the total growth in those who are driving alone. So we need to provide more opportunities and options throughout the community, more locations where people can live either near places where they can walk or bike more easily to the employment centers, or they can quickly and easily get out to a higher level services of transit. We also know that there are major capital asset issues, and maintenance has not been kept up with at the pace that it has needed to. This is not unique to Rochester. This is a challenge that communities all over the country are facing. We also have to take into account natural features. And really, when we look at that, roughly 40% of the land area is impacted by natural features with some level of protection. As we have grown up and out of the valley, especially as you think northeast, northwest is less so of an issue, but northeast, we run into steeper slopes and decor edge issues and other things that limit some of the opportunities for growth. But those are also areas that can grow. It's just that with some less efficiency, if you will, or with limitations to the natural features. The Northwest has fewer constraints in that regard. So I'm going to pause here for just a moment and see if you have any questions or comments for me at this point.
Questions, comments?
Okay, so framing the future vision. So the vision statement is an expression of community values, and this really grew out of a lot of public input and scanning through previous community engagement activities that had occurred. I think we've mentioned before, we've been quite aware that the community's been taxed on organizations to be part of community engagement issues and planning issues, and whether it's transportation, it's DMC, it's downtown, it's a public realm plan, or it's the comp plan, it's housing. People have been asked to come to a lot of things. So we tried to scan through other places where people had provided input, collect that together as well, and synthesize that, and also work with a community advisory committee to help develop the vision statement. And community values really reflect that people want a city where residents, workers, and visitors enjoy a high quality of life. It's characterized by safe and friendly neighborhoods with diverse and affordable housing options, where we're renowned as a center for growth and innovation with a robust economy. We offer balanced transportation options with well-planned neighborhoods, streets, sidewalks, trails, and transit. Where we value a commitment to health of the people and the air, water, and land that they depend on. Where we have a thriving downtown, a vibrant public spaces, and easy access to parks and open spaces. And where we are dedicated to the sustainable and responsible use of public resources and the provision of quality public services. So when we think about objectives in the plan and some of the outcomes, we can look at how we need to encourage growth inward and not outward. It does not mean that we ignore outward and edge growth. The plan still accommodates ample space for that. But our historic growth pattern has not had a great emphasis on looking at older declining corridors and locations where we really target some strategic reinvestment. We need to increase the share of travelers that are using alternative modes, walking, biking, and transit. We need to provide land use policies in urban form that also support that. We need to achieve a significant shift to downtown-related travel and nudge development toward a pattern that will create more energy, a more energy-efficient community. Some of the outcomes that we anticipate will come with this plan include support for a diverse, high-intensity city center that is the economic and cultural hub of the region with a growing residential population as well. Greater share of public dollars that can be directed to preservation of existing capital facilities. A strong market for transit pedestrian-oriented growth that revitalizes aging commercial corridors and centers and supports high-frequency transit. There is a very close tie between the reinvestment and redevelopment of our older core and being able to create some of the demand necessary to generate higher level of service on the transit system. And we expect that there'll be a public realm that is safe, accessible, and visually attractive that meets the needs of people of all ages, ultimately securing Rochester's future as an economic hub that competes very well with other communities across the country. Some of the strategies that we need to look at, again, we have taken a very integrated approach to looking at the land use and transportation, but we need to develop land use approaches that appropriately balance the change from new development against existing land uses, strategically encourage infill and redevelopment with policies and programs, and expand opportunities for housing diversity, small business expansion, and travel choice through greater use of mixed use and mixed density zoning concepts. And with that, we also need to incorporate complete streets and context-sensitive design, a commitment to core set of corridors connecting major destinations with downtown, and use land use to increase viability of the travel choices. Again, that's that tie between land use and destinations that help drive demand for transit service and fill the seats. Manage vehicular travel demand and pricing incentives, information convenience. There are seven core principles to the plan. Again, these are expressing community priorities. They include integrated land use and transportation, improve community connectivity, provide for diversity and housing choice, fiscal sustainability, health and wellness, enhance the integrity of existing neighborhoods, and social equity and environmental justice. So what is behind integrated land use and transportation planning? neighborhoods, districts, and corridors is affected by the transportation design. So they impact each other. Flexibility of transit is affected by the mix and intensity of uses, and there are some minimum densities and spatial distributions that really need to be achieved in order to build up the level of demand to make the transit more affordable. Form and pattern of development in an area will affect the ability to serve local travel demand by walking or biking. Urban design and distance to major destinations will be more important. Business and industry does need adequate access to materials, shipping, workforce, and customers. So again, not ignoring the need for mobility and broader community connectivity for freight and commuters. Some of the key goals, I'm just going to touch on the high-level pieces here, really is to incorporate pedestrian-oriented growth, especially in those areas that are closer in to the employment centers that have a decent access to nodes and major transit locations and transit lines, and to have transit-oriented growth. The integrated land use and transportation system includes transit-oriented growth on a primary transit network. I think with the transit development plan update, the five-year plan update, you saw some images of this primary transit network. We've talked about this in the past. Evaluating the existing conditions and service levels on the corridors that we have, we did identify the low-hanging fruit, if you will, those locations that are most likely able to achieve a bus rapid transit system in the course of this plan. As long as we are combining some of the land use strategies with that transit system objective, we think those objectives can be achieved. So what you see here in the red is the primary transit corridors. Those are the early stage, primary stage implementation sections that we anticipate will come to fruition during the life of this plan. The beyond 20-year time horizon would be shown more along the West Circle Drive on the north and the west sides as potential future segments of bus rapid transit to the primary transit network. The other thing that you see on this image are some generalized light blue blobs that identify one of the other pieces that we are looking at is we need to have some more permanent remote park and ride facilities. We have a series of them around the community, but we really don't have some permanent ones. And if we can integrate those with other land uses, you can get more bang for your buck, if you will, and get use out of those more than simply Monday through Friday during AM and PM peak hour. One thing I'd like to point out, this image does more than I can actually do with words, but it's a contrast to what an auto-dependent development style is versus a more transit-oriented development style. One of the things I'd like to draw to your attention that really isn't necessarily that obvious is your tax base that you get on the development style to the right is much higher than what you get on the left side. The number of square feet you're serving on the right is higher than what you're getting served on the left. So you're getting much more efficient use of all the public infrastructure that's adjacent to this, and you're getting a more livable, walkable style of development that contributes more to your tax base for the space that it's occupying. Some other images that help to demonstrate what the differences are between some auto-oriented and more pedestrian and transit-oriented development are here. Mixed use, as we've seen some hopefully in our community. We have pedestrian friendliness at these places because it's essential that people have the opportunity to walk or use their mobility aids to move around conveniently and independently. Remember, the greatest growth in our population is really in our households is persons over 65. We really have to make sure that we're providing ample space for people to be more independent. As people age, their disabilities increase and end up less ability to drive. And then transit amenities, this is just an example of something that shows a bus rapid transit line with more permanent infrastructure and investment for the bus system. One of the challenges we have is achieving the transit supportive density. So we've identified some of the very minimum amounts of density and compactness that need to be invested in certain locations in order to make this work. I'm not going to get into the weeds in this, but I do want to just point out that there's been, I'll just say, considerable analysis around these numbers and identifying what strategies and goals we really need to include so we know that we can achieve these things reasonably. And then we're going to have to take some new steps to introduce programs and implementation strategies that Rochester just hasn't used before.
Go ahead.
The underline says minimize intensity of 25 persons per acre, but I'm not sure how that's applying to the...
I think it's supposed to say minimum intensity,
okay.
So that's a typo.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. So if you look at the bottom, what we can see here is along the PTN corridors, there is a percentage of growth that really needs to be supported in those areas to help make that work. And in the urban expansion areas, there's certainly still considerable growth being allowed in those areas for greenfield development. But again, because of our demographic shifts in the community wants and desires and the competitiveness of this community against other communities across the country, we're seeing that there's clearly a need for us to shift in some of the direction that we've been in the past. So when we talk about expanding housing diversity, again, we need to have the ability to compete in the market for workers who depend on creating an expanded range of housing and choices and serve broader needs of a more diverse population. The changes in demographic makeup of households with a smaller proportion of traditional family units, an expanding proportion of one- and two-person adult households will need to be responded to in this planning horizon. We will see a continued shift in market needs and the kind of projects that are coming to you. We also recognize that there's expanding market of seniors who may be looking for opportunities to age in place and or take advantage of urban amenities. So one of the things that can be considered as well in our future is there a need to have some targeted programs that help seniors stay in their homes longer? There are some nonprofit entities that provide some assistance in providing handicap accessible adjustments within the home for restrooms and ramps and safety bars and so forth. But those are the things that we're going to be confronting. We have recognized there's a need to maintain an adequate supply of land that's zoned for a variety of different housing densities. Mm-hmm. We also recognize that there's a need to facilitate use of what we call the missing middle housing styles as a means to meet demand for affordable and walkable neighborhoods. And I think there's an image of that missing middle coming up here in a moment. We need to encourage housing that meets the unique needs of underserved groups such as seniors, people with disabilities, and the homeless, and develop design standards that will promote compatibility between housing of varied densities, especially when we're dealing with infill and redevelopment. So this is the image of what's called the missing middle. This has become a rather popular poster. I was in New York about a month ago and saw this on the storefront of a business in a quaint little downtown I was in. Yeah. It was really promoting that idea that we have single-family detached, and we have some townhomes and so forth, and we have the mid and high-rise more in the downtown, but there's some different housing choices in between that we have a very limited stock of. I'm not saying we don't have it. Yeah. It's just more limited. And with the shifts in demographics, there's going to be a need for more of those. So again, the plan is incorporating opportunities for those things to happen. Examples of missing middle housing styles are shown here. They include walkable context, a smaller footprint. Again, when you have smaller households, that makes more sense. Less off-street parking, lower perceived density, though it might not actually be a low density at all, well-designed units, and simple construction. So there are some target areas that we're suggesting be considered for this missing middle housing. And it's most appropriate as you get closer into the downtown. So if you think about that image with the spectrum of single-family detached lower density and the highest, you know, really being in your downtown, it's as you get closer into that core that you start to see those are the locations where there's more interest in that kind of housing and there's more demand for it. Certainly where we've been seeing a lot more of those types of proposals coming forward as well.
When you say higher density areas on that one, are you talking like... particularly once you get into the established neighbors, are you talking like missing middle type density or mid-rise type density?
Mostly missing middle type density, but there's a wide range of densities in that. Mm-hmm. When you think of high density, that's really more in the core of the downtown area.
About how many units per acre is an approximate dividing line between that middle and higher density?
We have a table that actually separates out the ranges and the numbers are not.
Is it coming up?
Off the top of my head. I don't know. It'll be a mystery.
Okay.
It'll be in the plan, though. If it's not in the slide deck, it'll be coming up. So we also need to look at community connectivity. It's really about neighborhood block layout also and street design that should create safe and legible conditions for walking within neighborhoods and to nearby destinations. Large oversized blocks in new neighborhoods and subdivisions should be avoided in favor of smaller blocks that enhance a pedestrian network and enhances circulation throughout the area as well. And we need to ensure there is sufficient travel capacity to support growth in the central core of the city. That's not being overlooked by any means. When we think about that, that travel capacity extends well beyond the core of the downtown, because again, we're anticipating roughly 52,000 commuters within the timeline of this plan horizon. We're already nearing 40,000. We need to respond to changing travel behavior needs and improve and expand the travel choices again. Some other principles related to community connectivity refers to the wide variety of options that collectively create a system that facilitate convenient movement of people and goods within Rochester. Okay, so this is a wide range of different systems. It's streets, it's highways, it's sidewalks and trails, and so forth. And it's the transit system as well. We need to have quality and convenience of connectivity, including things that we need to think about there include patterns and intensity of land use, design of the transportation network, quality and model of mobile connections and services, and the cost in time and money for travel options. So when travel options for driving alone become more timely and costly than other choices like walking, biking, or transit, people start to shift their behaviors. We know that we have limited capacity on our corridors leading in and out of downtown, and as that capacity gets filled up, the time for people to use those systems during peak hour will go down. Actually, the time will go up. The efficiency of their time will go down a lot, but the amount of time they spend in their vehicles will go up. So there are some issues that we need to address, and again, we've incorporated that into the plan. Establishing a primary transit network has been one of the main solutions that we've identified here. Enhancing local transit service, continue to expand that basic transit service that will provide a minimum level of service all day. But on that primary transit network, we think we can reach higher levels of service morning through night, 7 days a week. If we can get to a bus rapid transit system, that's typically a system in which people don't have to use a schedule because there's a bus that comes roughly every 10 or 15 minutes. It's more reliable and predictable. We need to continue to build complete streets and really have a transportation system that serves all users conveniently and safely. Develop fully connected networks of starting from the neighborhood level on up. Accommodate new shared mobility options. So the transportation industry and transportation systems are changing very rapidly. We have not seen rapid change here locally, but we have been observing that rapid change in other communities, not only in the United States, but in other locations. We have to keep an eye on those trends, and in future plan updates, we may need to adjust some of the strategies that we include here, because it may require us to look at our transportation system.
So maybe this goes back to that table, too, but is there a threshold for an approximate households per acre that's required to support primary transit?
Yes.
Ballpark?
I don't have it. I just not on top of my head.
You're breaking my heart.
I know. We also need to begin to shift the paradigm for travel from one of improving mobility to one of improving accessibility and access to convenience of connections that should be made by a wide range of different travel options. So, another thing that we really need to be incorporating here is being cognizant again that we have commuters coming in from outside locations. We need to have a system of more remote park and ride systems. There may be a need to be working with other communities where they have promotion around the regional commuters. Get fewer people in their cars, you know, from home, but make that regional commuter option with buses even easier. So looking at the remote park and rides, the downtown peripheral parking, which is part of the integrated transit studies for the DMC right now, we want to link these things with express buses and a primary transit network. Eventually we're going to have a downtown circulator that will be serving that part of the community. And we are also in the process of working on downtown parking policy, and we will need to have travel demand management strategies. Again, that's one, that element itself is being addressed through the integrated transit studies. When we think about local street development, some of the priorities here are that block layout street design should create safe and legible conditions, provide an attractive environment, and be safer for pedestrians, bicyclists, and drivers. Be interconnected internally with adjacent residential properties and adjacent destinations. Establish traffic management strategies that reduce the intrusion of trucks, commuter traffic, and cut-through traffic in lower volume residential streets and quieter neighborhoods. Where the established street pattern and design is in an established neighborhood that may not conform to current street standards, we need to allow for some alternative design standards for those two. So enhanced neighborhood integrity, what does some of these words mean? It's really about strengthening the quality and character of existing neighborhoods while accommodating reinvestment through infill and development. Those things can sometimes be in conflict, but we need to strike a balance in those. We need to delineate areas where redevelopment can be transformative and develop implementation strategies that support transitional design features and ensure quality and value is added with that change. We also need to delineate areas where the aim is to preserve the character of the existing neighborhoods. Make needed investments in public realm and design new neighborhoods as integral parts of the broader community fabric. This is just an example of calling out, this is only one example of calling out managing form and design and how that is elevating in importance in our future. We need to encourage infill and redevelopment, but that comes with the need to have design that complements or extends the positive qualities of surrounding development and adjacent buildings, or at least enhances that area. It can be transformative again, but we need to delineate those geographically. And the principle of maintaining a commitment to health and wellness of Rochester and the people and the environment. One example of this is that the built environment does influence behaviors, safety, and health. Safe and convenient movement for pedestrians, transit users, and bicycles. Bicyclists does support healthier, more livable community. People who use transit get more physical activity in a daily routine than people who do not. Obviously, the sidewalks and trail systems and the safety and convenience of those provide opportunities for people to be more mobile in an active, physically active line. So some of the things that you'll see in the plan related to goals and policies on this topic would include well-connected park, natural areas, and trail systems, creating a vision, plan, and implementation program for establishing green infrastructure, encourage the use of urban design tools that incorporate active living into the built environment, provide opportunities for urban agriculture, and integrate complete streets in urban form. And I'm just going to pause to take a sip here. I'm sorry you're not getting more variety. You know, Charlie and I were going to do a show for you today. another item that's addressed in here, again, this is a community value that we really heard, is that there's a value for equity and environmental, social equity and environmental justice in our community. Understanding that a community that welcomes diversity ensures that resources and opportunities are equally available to residents of all neighborhoods across the city. Transportation, affordable housing, and a safe, pleasant neighborhood environment are at the center of those opportunities. The map that you're seeing here is actually from an access and mobility limited study that we did of households where there's a higher density of households that either do not have an automobile or they have fewer automobiles than the drivers in the home, so there's more dependence on walking, biking, and transit. And did some evaluation around the availability and the safety and condition of the non-motorized system to help people get to the transit stops or to their destinations without that access to an automobile. We need to ensure that public actions create a safe, welcoming environment in all neighborhoods for persons of diverse age, ability, race, ethnicities, and economic backgrounds. Another key principle here is fiscal sustainability. Some of you might remember when we went through the scenario planning process, we brought to you a graphic that showed a whole bunch of different metrics about if we continue our future growth consistent with past trends in terms of the patterns and disperseness of our growth, here are some things that we can reasonably anticipate. If we go with a more compact pattern with XYZ, here are some things we can anticipate. And you may recall that there was there were some clear divisions there between different densities and styles of development and the overall fiscal sustainability of the community. Some of the things that we're suggesting here is that the growth patterns do significantly affect the way in which government provides key city services such as police, fire, transit, park and rec facilities, educational systems, and arts and amenities. We really need to keep that in mind with the plan as well. The land uses, urban design patterns, and densities basically do impact the ultimate cost to build the infrastructure, but the long-term operations and maintenance. Some communities are using a fix-it-first policy, a fix-it-first approach, where they're really prioritizing fixing the existing infrastructure and prioritizing more efficient use of the existing facilities through reinvestment and growth patterns, but take advantage of those facilities.
On that particular front, I think I've lamented probably too much to enumerate the number of times I've had this conversation, but as council and as kind of staff work together to do this, does the plan look to establish some metrics whereby we can evaluate proposals on these grounds?
The plan, I don't think, will include all the metrics you're going to need. It will include guidance on those things, but I do think it's going to be very important for us as a community to develop a dashboard of metrics that identify whether we are or are not headed in the right direction on some of these objectives. So we're going to need to implement new strategies. We're going to have to test whether they're working. We're not going to know that within a 12-month time period, but at least within a 3 to 5 year window, we should be able to start to evaluate those trends.
I understand that some of them are community objectives, I guess I would say, in terms of our goals. I think what I'm kind of interested in is having some mechanism to that the development community can participate in that says, you can know ahead of time that the council is going to be less receptive to a plan that lands in the yellow or the red on the scale versus something that's in the, you know, I don't know, orange or green or whatever we want the other colors to be. But, you know, is there, and I'm going to cut myself off as not necessarily being pertinent, but I think what you're getting at here in terms of fiscal sustainability to me is something we have to enter into as partners with the people that are working to actually get out and develop projects and go forward here. So I think that's really, I'm glad to see it, and I was glad to see it in the plan, but I just kind of put a bug in your ear to think about how we can put together that dashboard or put together something a little bit more responsive to work with the community. So.
Mr. Wojcik?
I would add to that too that we, right now the process is basically we get a GDP, we approve the GDP, and there's never any discussion as to whether or not the roads that might be contained within a subdivision will be able to sustain them in the long run. How do we get from that mentality today to where, as we're deciding whether or not to accept public infrastructure, we have some sort of discussion or analysis, seeing if we can afford it or not? Is that something that's going to come from the planning department? Is that something that's going to require explicit city council action to initiate that process? How do we get there?
I don't know if it'll come from the planning department. I don't have that answer right now, but I think there's clearly a way for that to be documented. Theoretically, you could, with each project that expands the infrastructure system, identify, you know, here's the upfront capital cost, but in 20, 30, 50 years, incrementally, what are your operations and maintenance costs? I would have to lean, obviously, on Public Works to help with much of that, but there's annual maintenance, there's snow removal, but then there's need for reconstruction. Like, I'm just talking streets now.
Yep.
Reconstruction and so forth. You can put that in a table that shows when, what years you're going to be incurring those expenses.
They've kind of flipped it on.
They
flipped on its head a little bit, right? Because they're coming back to us, and I thought this was a real positive, coming back and recommending areas for development that are affordable for the city to maintain. So it's a similar sort of process. You guys are kind of coming at it from the other end and saying we can kind of calculate the costs and then target areas that are affordable. The other alternative is to go forward on every plan and kind of figure out what the cost is kind of the two approaches.
Okay. They're certainly not mutually exclusive, those two approaches either. And I do think, you know, what we've done is we've analyzed what we have for a road network today, and staff's numbers came up that was about a $1.4 billion liability going into the future. And obviously, we don't want to increase that number over time. We want to decrease it. And I guess each time we would accept a money-losing project, that would move us in the wrong direction.
Well, another piece you should know in the background is that we have worked with the different infrastructure departments, including Public Works, mostly with Public Works, but also with RPU and Park and Rec, to take a look at, as the planning horizon for this plan up to 2040 or a little beyond, where are the areas that we have the most efficient use of existing investments? And we've identified those areas in the urban growth boundary for the city, and those areas in which it's much more expensive to serve or expand, and maybe even unnecessary within the horizon of this plan, we're not identifying those as priorities for future growth. So that's one way we've included fiscal sustainability as well. Ultimately, this plan does include new opportunities for reinvestment and more compact growth, and that will in itself reduce the pace of asset growth and the residual long-term operations and maintenance costs and make more efficient use of existing systems. Does anyone need a break?
Do you need a break?
Pause for a moment, then we'll go on to this next piece. I think I only have about 10 slides left to cover today, and then we'll get into some other pieces in 2 weeks. But what you'll see next includes some of the maps that I think people have been having to take a look at. So I'm going to make you wait just for a moment.
Do we get into updated timelines or anything later on?
I can address that when we get to our
Okay, perfect.
Yep. So, proposed tools for managing growth include both that land use framework and the transportation framework. Those frameworks are identified in the literature of the plan. This will include a layered structure inside. The transportation system will include primary transit network map and policy, vehicular roadway system map and policy, pedestrian network map and policy, a bike network map and policy. And in terms of travel services goals and policies, we will be addressing the non-PTN transits overall, transit service, commuter services, travel options and demand management, and shared mobility. I just want to point out that the long-range transportation plan that currently serves is a formal component of both the City of Rochester and Olmsted County's comprehensive plan, has included elements that are more heavily focused in on an urban area. We've drawn out from that plan some of these pieces that are being incorporated and customized into this plan to better reflect that this is unique more to the City of Rochester. Okay. Important guidelines that will guide future growth in the city. Some of the things that we need to understand is that downtown will be a prime focus for future Rochester growth, that medium and higher density growth and development will be aligned along key transit-oriented nodes and corridors. Maintenance and, where needed, revitalization of mature neighborhoods through appropriate infill and redevelopment will be encouraged. And growth on the edge of the city will be fiscally sustainable, with an emphasis on directing growth to areas where the adequate infrastructure capacity exists to support the needs of future residents and businesses. Again, that's already reflected in the maps that we've created. We can start to see. So this is the urban area growth concept map. And what I'm going to point out here is really the gray area is the current municipal service area. The yellow is the expanse of what we anticipate will be needed to serve the city to 2040. It truly includes enough land area and land designation for different land use categories to accommodate growth probably to 2050. Okay? We use more than what's needed in that space to make sure there's buffer and there isn't such a tight margin within the market that it drives the prices up real high. We do that for all the different land use categories, so I want you to feel assured that this is not a tight plan that only accommodates that growth up to 2040. But the yellow area really defines for you what do you need to think about in terms of your priorities for investment and some of your priorities for public service strategies in those areas. That can accommodate a population of up to 150,000 to 175,000. Mm-hmm. So again, beyond the life of this plan. The urban reserve area is the brown area. We anticipate will be a growth area that accommodates the community, it actually should say beyond 2060, to accommodate a population of roughly 210,000 to 235,000. Some of this depends on future trends that we can't know right now, but if there is continued trending toward more urban and compact growth, we may not need as much land area, obviously. The pink area shows what we are calling the urban influence area growth beyond 2060. Really, it's for population beyond 235,000. And the kind of light blue areas that are shown really are there to show you that those are constraint areas past suburban subdivisions that have been developed in the county and the non-City of Rochester locations. They have created some constraints for future growth, and that's reflected there. So one of the things I want to point out, I don't know if I have it in another slide here, is you recently looked at a future sewer shed map for the City of Rochester, mm-hmm. the ultimate gravity flow sewer sheds that mm-hmm. the city could anticipate. That ultimate sewer shed is much bigger than this, okay? Mm-hmm. That ultimate sewer shed will accommodate roughly 80 to 100 plus years of the community's growth.
Just kind of a general question here. The areas that are in yellow, do any of them require major sewer upgrades? It looks like the ones that we know are bad are not in the yellow.
No, actually, we did some fiscal analysis with Public Works and with the consultant who had worked, HDR, who worked on the sewer study, and did identify cost factors associated with different segments of the community mm-hmm. where additional sanitary sewer capacity or major upgrades would be needed. This turns out to be that combined with some other things. You can't make decisions solely based on that, but that combined with other things led us to this map that really emphasizes those areas where we can most efficiently serve new growth. So, where we can avoid costs within the next 25 years that may be necessary 50 to 70 years from now, but we do not need to incur them now.
So looking at the north end of that, I assume that kind of hard stop there is 65th Street, and the what is yellow that goes north of 65th is drainage that can go into the current sewer gravity feed?
Well, that would demonstrate the Menards property that you see there on the west
just,
side.
Yeah, the small
the
area right
side,
off of 52.
I don't think all the stuff on the east side is actually gravity flow, but that would go back into the lift station, right? That's over
the ones
east
that are
side.
Already there.
Right.
But when you go a little bit further to the west, I noticed that it starts to creep up to the northwest. Does that allow a gravity access point, or is that actually lift stations as well to get that
I'm
northwest?
I'm not sure which piece you're referring to.
It's gravity, Michael.
Thank you.
All right. All right, so again, we have this current municipal service area that's defined, the urban expansion area, which provides area needed to reasonably supply land for greenfield and edge growth up to 2040. Again, it's really enough to get us up probably to 2050 or beyond. The urban reserve area it identifies as most suitable for expansion beyond 2040. And development of that area should be accounted for in future infrastructure planning. The other thing is that we need to use those type of boundaries as strategies to work with adjacent jurisdictions to make sure that we're preserving the city's opportunities for growing, and we do not have constraints created by other investments in those locations. So something like interim development strategies are used now to make sure that developments are designed so that they can eventually hook up to city sewer and water facilities. That's the type of thing we need to keep in mind. And we also have this urban influence area, which indicates land that could be potentially urbanized in 40 to 60 plus years in time frame. This is the ultimate sewer shed map that you have seen previously. Again, this plan helps to prioritize the target investment for the next 20 to 30 years, and the total area shown in this really addresses 80 to 100 plus years of the city's growth. So by having a plan, it can help to prioritize where do we need the investments and what kind of investments do we need and how are we going to pay for those too. This is the development vision map, and the purpose of this is to identify place types. So this is kind of creating some categories of the types of places that highlight different development contexts or forms that exist or will be encouraged in Rochester's urban service area. It's a designation of place types that provides a way to organize thinking about and development policies for areas of distinct character. And it's intended as a high-level representation of the core principles of the plan. So, and this might be a little difficult to read, but you can see some blobs and stars really long, if you remember the primary transit network and some future implementation phases of that network. Identifying transit-oriented major mixed-use areas, transit-oriented brayfield and revitalization. There's something called a transit-oriented employment center, which really means that it's not necessarily as mixed-use. It's primarily employment, so it has more Monday through Friday kind of activity. The other areas are intended to be far more mixed-use, so they have activities throughout the week, 7 days a week.
So if we look at the area, and I'll come back to this later, South Broadway, mm-hmm. It looks like there is an identified transit-oriented development, secondary mixed-use general area down there, right around the intersection of Broadway and 3rd Avenue. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a question towards the end of this that I want to come back to. How do we make sure we don't shoot ourselves in the foot in the meantime?
The development vision, again, kind of categorizes these into different place types. corridors and districts. Place types with the neighborhoods include a geographic area in which residents have common sense of identity or perceive that they have common interests, their basic building block out of the environment in Rochester, and are the areas that most residents consider home. Vary widely in size, composition, and character. Neighborhoods should be walkable and connected. Include a mix of housing types with destinations such as schools, parks, and neighborhoods, and shopping. Centers really are places of focused higher intensity development for residents to shop, cook, and gather. They include a variety of center types that provide opportunities for development that focus on model-oriented commercial activity, but also a diverse set of mixed-use development that encourages walkable urban development and enhanced transit service. Smaller sites that support implement the development of distinct, more neighborhood service areas. And centers are generally located in highly accessible areas. In some instances, more auto-oriented than in others, where others might be more transit-oriented. Okay, striking that balance because we don't need all of only one thing, a variety. A transit-oriented centers will introduce a new class of land use category in our lexicon. The districts are large areas of activity and more general in nature. They'll comprise a large portion of the city's land area. And generally be developed at lower densities or intensity and reliant on private vehicles, primarily more auto-oriented and less transit-oriented. The corridors provide for a means of connection between different areas or destinations, and they have an emphasis on integrated land use and transportation together and do include the primary transit network and priority areas for complete streets. So, some of the key principles in developing this vision include identifying locations where you have more compact activity centers, community destinations. You have a complete network that provides circulation and access for people using all different modes. You have comprehensive transportation options, compact, mixed, and diverse land uses, and carefully designed streets and facilities. This map is really intended to identify areas of stability and change. Okay, so when we do a future plan for a community, there are vast areas of the city we anticipate very, very little change will happen. Okay, especially newer neighborhoods that are maybe only 15, 20, 30 years old, they're relatively stable. They may see some change, but not drastic change. So this was an attempt to identify those areas where we anticipate there's going to be new growth, edge growth, that's identified here more on the grayscale. We're on edges. Areas of stability, kind of that more muted yellowy tone. Established neighborhoods, primarily outside of that downtown area. And established business, certain established business areas. And then the urban reserve. So that urban reserve is, again, preserving the community's future growth needs. We don't anticipate a lot of change in those areas. And then there's areas of change. Again, these are some of the new categories we're seeing in our land use plan, is that transit-oriented category, whether it's a growth corridor or it's a node. And then there's the residential reinvestment, those locations that are closer into the downtown. We talked about that being part of this missing middle. And we've already seen trends and a lot of interest in redevelopment in those areas. We just need to be a little bit more focused on identifying and delineating some boundaries around that. And then areas of development constraint. So I don't know if you can see the shading down at the far bottom of the map. Maybe you can't see it from back there, but that really identifies, we have an airport protection area that we need to be mindful of. We demonstrate that on a map so people understand that that is a limiting factor, and it helps people to understand what their future opportunities or constraints for growth might be in there. And then we have a future land use map. A lot of this is going to look like the existing land use map. Okay? It's the areas of change that we're going to see some different categories and some new designations. And so this really has to traditional poor neighborhoods, and some other categories. Again, a lot of this is going to look the same because a lot of this is in that stability area, but you will see some areas of change.
Are these slides out on the Planning to Succeed website right now?
They are not right now. We were working on them until moments before.
But you'll be able to put them up shortly then?
We will.
It's just
this week.
There's so much to see here
that
we probably need a Captain Crunch decoder ring to zoom in on it all.
Well, and the expectation is that I introduce these today.
Yeah.
We're going to revisit these when we come back in 2 weeks, and we're going to do a little deeper dive on some of this. And I think this is the area we may want more discussion.
Could you help me a little bit on the west side, that purple color, purple, blue, whatever it is, going out the north of 14?
Yeah, industrial. So,
okay.
Area for future industrial growth.
Okay. Thank you.
Again, so here's a matrix of the different land use categories. You have residential type of categories on the far left, mixed use, non-residential community acres and reservation areas. The ones that are highlighted in yellow are primarily what's new. And again, you're not going to see them everywhere in the city. You see them in the areas of change, anticipated change. Okay, I am way more efficient than I anticipated because I thought we were going to take more time. But what we cover today is really an introduction to what the plan is, the forces that are shaping the plan, understanding some of the trends that we have to manage as we move forward, the volume of growth that we're going to have in this next 20, 25 years, and how that compares to the previous 50-something years. This is a really different pace which we'll be working. And in the future, we're going to be covering, again, more discussion about translating the vision to policy and some of the action steps. We have had considerable growth in our past. There's no doubt about that. But the level of number of permits and activities and so forth that will happen in the future here will surpass what we expect.
I think our population was about 54,000 in 1980. Correct?
I have to look. It was 75,000, about 93.
1984, 57, 1990,
it was
70.
In 90,
but I think
it
was about 54.
Anyway, one question. Are we going to have to revise the urban and growth area map in this process? We don't have to, but.
The urban expansion area shown here largely conforms to that. I will actually turn to Sandy now because she knows right now.
No, as Charlie and I have been going through that, those boundaries are pretty well mirroring exactly what we have today. That was kind of intentional because I know there was a lot of discussion back and forth.
Yeah, we had a 50-year growth area. We had a 25-year growth area that was always in the comp plan until about the mid-90s.
Yeah.
It became a 50-year growth area.
Yep.
Good to look at getting the whole sewer shed as far as the growth area that is preserved rather than a year. I know that goes way out, but if it's physically able to serve it with gravity sewer, it should be in the city growth area.
And I think the balance to that is that you've got property owners that may have opportunities to do something different in 75 to 100 years that we have to be.
You can be reasonable, but you don't have to allow urban growth in those areas from other jurisdictions, for example.
Yes.
Could I ask you a question on that slide? I see you're talking about 50,000 new jobs by 2040 and 50,000 new residents, kind of a correlation of one to one. But I had a question on that. If you talk about 50,000 new jobs, potentially those are, you know, multi-individual families, you know, one person. So that makes me wonder, is the population understated based on the number of jobs?
Actually, the growth in jobs here will far outpace the growth in population. And that is the key source of our labor force gap.
And
it's not unique just to here, but it is, it's going to be a significant issue, and it has become one. That's part of why we need to be more creative about being a more attractive and competitive economic
center. They also pointed out that there's going to be 19,000 new commuters. So I think that factors in if you think of how the commuters come in, with some of those jobs being taken up by people who are commuting into the cities.
I Mr. Rojic, and then Mr. Hickey.
So, well, I, you know, this through no fault of your own personally, this has dragged on for a very, very long time. And the first target for a draft, I think, was fourth quarter of 2015 when they first started the process. And that's not a personal slight on you, because there's a bunch of stuff that factors into that, and resources being first and foremost among that. That said, every time we have one of these, I still want to see, I want to know what is the timeline to making decisions that formalize some of this. When do we actually see this become the plan of the community? And the example that I brought up earlier, to the South Broadway, it really concerns me, and you should receive some notes from me. Right in the heart of what's supposed to be a new node of transit-oriented development, we're talking about a massive strip mall with surface parking right now, and at some point we have to flip the switch so we can protect the future growth of the community. When can we do that?
Well, we anticipate that sections 2 and 3 will be posted in May. We'll be moving into, at some point after that, public hearings. I can't tell you how long it's going to take to get through that into adoption, because there's a political process that's involved in that, and we don't have control over it. So, when it is adopted, move into implementation. That vision becomes then the roadmap for our future. We're in a time of transition. I responded to you in your email. We are in a time of transition. We're going to have some sites that proceed and develop as they might have without this vision, and we'll have some sites that proceed and develop with it as shown in this vision.
Okay, Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, I talk about this every time, but so I see it's not going to incorporate all the independent plans in from the city. So those independent plans kind of popped up over time, because we had a 40-year-old comp plan. We said we need this to supplement it, we need this to supplement it. So in the end, when we have an adopted comprehensive plan and we've done some of the, you know, ordinances to, you know, put it into place, we need to have a clear process to deconflict these independent plans, because developers need to go in with one rule book to know what they're... Right now, we have a process where people pull out the favorite page from one appendix or another that agrees with them, mm-hmm. and we kind of ignore the fact that there's conflict. So whether it's, you know, a table at the front of the plan or something, we need to have a clear way that says, when there's a conflict, this plan supersedes this plan, and here's the roadmap. So when someone comes in to develop, they know they've got one rule book to work from, and they don't have to be trying to, you know, search out for appendices of other plans.
That might be a topic for the council to discuss at another meeting, is that we do have some sub-area or small area plans that are unique to very constrained geographic areas. Do you want those to be sunsetted with the adoption of this, or do they live on and only to the extent that they're not in
right.
This one.
Well, I mean, I think ideally they would be sunsetted, but if it turns out that's not practical, then as a minimum there needs to be a hierarchy that says when this plan that, you know, wasn't sunsetted is in conflict, you know, this plan supersedes.
I agree with what Mr. Rick is saying, from the standpoint that I think there are some that are going to be fairly easy to sunset, like the Second Street Corridor plan. We're going to have pretty good corridor guidance, it looks like, out of this. The downtown master plan and the DMC plans are obviously
sure.
more current. And so I don't necessarily prescribe what the solution would be to that, but a constant set of rules for everybody to play by would make everyone's life easier.
Mr. Bilderman?
Mitzi, you said you talked with Public Works and Parks. Are you making sure you keep the fire department, police department involved? Because as the city continues to grow, we're going to have more fire stations as well as probably more precincts. So are they also involved in your conversations?
They have been, actually. When they've been looking at properties, they've had an interaction with us about where do we anticipate the growth will happen and what timeline, so they can inform their priorities for property.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Campion.
I actually thought the section one did a pretty decent job of explaining why it's maybe a bit hopeful to sunset all those plans. And mm-hmm. I would hate to, I agree with the complexity of the environment to do development. On the same token, like, something that can focus on a small area and give a plan that is really tactile to a specific area versus the master plan, which is talking really, you know, high level. I think some of those small area plans are really kind of an interesting concept for that, giving people an explanation about what they can expect to develop in an area and going beyond our basic level of overall kind of community guidance. So I guess I would hate for them to get a bad name. I do understand that they're complex, and I have been frustrated and shared frustration, frankly, on deconflicting them in certain spots. And yet I hope that we can kind of embrace certain areas of town getting those sorts of plans, because it is a way to put some foresight and forethought into what we're doing. And DMC certainly did that in a big way downtown. But there are going to be other spots, and I think these nodes are a really interesting example that if someone showed up with an idea, we're going to develop in this node, and we're going to be the backbone of this node, here's our plan. That, to me, is a really compelling idea for the city to get behind, then, is to say, you know, maybe it's, I'd hate to call it the mini DMC, but we're going to do these little development areas around town that get that sort of plan, and we're going to work collaboratively with private parties there. Small area plans, I think, is I'm hearing. It is a really compelling thing to me, so I appreciate the need to sunset and at least have some clarity with the existing plans about what will be the precedent going forward. But I like that idea. I at least like the idea from the standpoint of a master plan can't do everything, otherwise it'd get kind of bled to death by too many different directions.
Mitzi, I had a question. Philosophically, do you think the plan, once it's adopted, would be prescriptive enough that we would not consider things like special services districts or restricted development or incentive, you know, those sort of nuances that we've created, this kind of a recent animal that we've created in the ensuing years to kind of fill the gap? Are you anticipating that the new plan would eliminate the need for those sorts of things, or is that too unrealistic?
That would not be an immediate step, because the plan is not zoning. You have to change your zoning policy mm-hmm. in order to address that. So it lays the groundwork for us to perhaps establish some new policies around infill redevelopment, where we may be able to identify if you do X, Y, Z, this is an over-the-counter permit, right? Or here's a new process, but here are the things you follow. So that we can avoid restricted incentive as much. I don't think that those tools will completely go away, but that will be a decision for a future council to make.
Yeah, and I think I could partially answer my own question. As much as we would like that to be the case and we would strive for that, it may not be entirely practical. 8 years ago, no one conceived of DMC, and look at the impact that that's having and on our planning and so forth. So it's hard to project what the needs might be, you know, in 2030, 2040, or beyond. We'll do the best we can, and hopefully this plan survives 40 years like the last one. We'll see.
People need to be updated more often. I think the world's changing.
All right, Mr. Campy.
One more on that. I think that's a really interesting objective if we kind of look at reducing. So I think one of the metrics for us to look at is the number of times we have to go back to those tools as we move forward. You know, if we're continuing to revisit restricted developments at the same rate once we've adopted this new plan, I would consider that a bit of an issue. You know, part of the plan is to bring into alignment where we're going with what we're seeing. Second piece is, presumably, when we adopt the comprehensive plan, we have portions of the existing zoning code that reference the comprehensive plan. They're referencing the currently adopted comprehensive plan. Is that correct? So we would have a period of time here where it's going to be somewhat of a challenge as people move through the system with existing zoning code and a comprehensive plan that certainly calls out. And I in no way intend to try and avoid that, but just to kind of, is there an intermediary set of tools we can be looking at now? Maybe that's what good reason to keep around restricted development and other tools as we go forward. Is I can certainly see we're going to have some challenges as we kind of migrate through plan to plan. I assume this has been done before, and there are best practices from other kind of communities and ourselves we can kind of leverage for that.
And in fact, that might be where the tools get used more so as a bridge between a new comp plan and existing zoning codes, and we use those tools we have to kind of bridge that until we get there. Mr. Wojcik.
So back to, I was just doing the math in my head. Chapters 2 and 3, which are the details of the plan, get published in May. I assume then that would begin a one or two phase adoption step of going to the Planning and Zoning Commission, other boards and commissions, City Council. Is that a 60-day process then, do you think? Or assuming, you know, we can put the brakes on at any point, but assuming we don't put the brakes on and we move towards adoption, how, you know, assuming we get it in mid-May, when do we have that final vote?
I can't answer that question for you because they don't have control over some of the timeline elements. We anticipate we'll have to do more community engagement. We have some sessions already scheduled in May. Depending on how those go, we may need additional community engagement and meetings with commission and meetings with council.
So, once
we've completed that stage, theoretically, the public hearing process should be 60 days.
So understanding that there's some variability, could we at least ask for a best case timeline with where the additional more work may be needed, so we have something that we can focus on?
Oh, I'd say maybe best case is August.
I mean, would it be possible? I mean, I don't need it right now, but I'm saying, would it be possible for you to produce a timeline of what the best case process would be, and then understanding that if it changes, it changes. But I just want something to focus on for a date.
Is that something asking for as a whole?
Well, I think, like you said, you know, some of the public commentary and so forth, that's an unknown right now. I think we all really want this done as soon as possible, but...
Done right.
To some extent, it's more in your hands than it is in Missy's hands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, so I think
she's heard that you want it done as soon as possible.
Just the dates that are firm, if you're saying you're sending out public input stuff, I think if we can get that as soon as possible, because part of it is May is surprisingly filling up already with a lot of other stuff going on. So if we can get those dates, because I'd like to make sure to clear the calendar and be available to participate and to make sure we're all observant of what's going on. I understand that you want the full plan, but to me it's on us. Like, that's on us.
Fine, but what I say is I want some guidance so we can try and, if we're slowing it down, that's on us, but... We can see what she can come back with, and if that's not good enough to meet our needs, we can, you know, come up with some direction for otherwise.
And the chapters are available. We can adopt it at any time. We can have a public hearing, and you can have the adoption, but I would like to make sure we're all on the same page about what we're working to adopt. So let's see what the chapters are and see how much work we have to do to reach a consensus about what to bring forward, and then we can figure out the plan here.
Mr. Bilderbach?
I think asking her to give us a date is unrealistic, because if we're asking her to take it to all these commissions, committees, go back to public hearings, she's got no idea. And I think it all depends on how well they go or not go, and that's going to be the decision maker when things come back to us, or do they need to go back to the drawing board. So, I mean, I think it's nice to say May, but realistically, if we know that we have a very active community, and so there'll be many people who will be out offering adjustments to this plan. I think that's a nice idea, but I think realistically we should not expect it.
I don't need a hard date. I just want a timeline. I want to know what the steps are, and we don't have that right now.
The steps.
Can we agree that we need the steps?
Well, but I think it's going to be next to impossible for her to tell you right now, because if she does public hearings and goes back to these commissions, they're going to all want time to have feedback, push back to her. I don't know if we can realistically ask that. I mean, she said she'd do public hearings starting in May. That might be as much as we can expect.
No.
I didn't say public hearings in May. So the release of sections 2 and 3.
Yeah, I was trying to move you along.
Does the state define
it?
I think it's reasonable to ask for steps in a rough timeline and mm-hmm. see where it goes.
General timeline.
One of the big things, if you're happy with what you're hearing at this meeting and the next hearing, it tells her they're on the right page.
We'll see how the next one goes.
Thing. So, the sooner you get your input into her and their staff, the better off you are. So.
Mr. Campion?
I thought it was very well put together. In particular, I thought the perspective on where our community is at and where it is going was spot on. And I think that I hope that the strategies for addressing that are as crystal clear as I felt the message was about where we're headed. So I'm looking forward to chapters 2 and 3, I think, like many people, but I think if it's the same level of work that I think came out of that first chapter, I'm really interested in getting public feedback about it, because I thought it was, it addressed all of the challenges that as a council we've been looking to kind of put our fingers on a spot on the map, so I appreciated that.
Mr. Watkins?
It's good that we do the audio recording, because the various questions that came up, obviously we can go back and see whatever, you know, some of the tables we were looking for some additional information. Almost everything I saw here, I agree with. I don't have a lot of concerns with it. Honestly, 95% of what I've seen here, I've seen other presentations as well, so there's not a whole lot necessarily that was new. But based on this message, I would say give it some teeth as soon as possible.
Did you have a
comment?
I do not. No.
Okay, Mr. Ross. Missy, one of the things you said at the beginning was that this is a guide, not defined. So, in essence, this is going to give us the structure to make our decisions on, but it still goes back to the governing body. I mean, we're not going to have it so defined that everything is, we're a transportation hub, is we're a transportation hub, or a node is identified, that's, I mean, we don't have a specific spot, we have specific areas, and this is the concept that works. Ultimately, it comes back to the governing body to make those final decisions, is that correct?
Final decisions come back, and zoning tools are one of your major implementation tools.
Right.
Okay, so those tools will need to be changed.
Okay, very good.
All right. I think as you hinted, the details are really forthcoming in sections 2 and 3, so that should be a far more interesting discussion, perhaps. I think, as Mr. Wojcik said, philosophically it's difficult to argue with much of what's been presented today. The fun is yet to come, I suppose.
And I don't know if there'll be any surprises to come. It's
right.
Just a little bit more of how do we get to where we
mm-hmm.
said we're going to go.
Right.
All right. Any other questions then for today on this topic?
Thank you, Mitzi.
All right.
Thanks,
Mitzi.
Appreciate
your work. We'll send the note with the engagement dates and locations for you, probably by the end of the week.
Thank you.
Okay.
You can tell Charlie we said you're much more engaging.
Well, and I shouldn't let this meeting end without giving recognition to Charlie Ryder and Sandy Gosley, who have poured a tremendous amount of extra time into this project. The consultants gave us great material, but we really needed to customize it for this community and really bring the Rochester flavor to it and some of the uniqueness that I think you need to be well connected with the community to be able to know and reflect into the plan.
Charlie is the client.
And Sandy, too, they've done a tremendous job.
Charlie is the kind of nerdy numbers guy that makes me proud.
All right. Any other business then for this afternoon, Ms. Johnson?
I actually just, I could probably say this at the council meeting, but I wanted to thank the fire department for their hard work this weekend with that fire on 6th Street. That's actually the block that my business is on, so thank you for not letting the block burn down and keeping it contained. I read something about you never need that many people until you need that many people. So thank you. If you can relay that message back for me, that'd be great.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Anything else? Then we will wrap up a little early and I'll see everyone in a couple hours.
So your business is in my ward. So if you have
issues,
bring it to your.
Well, I do have an issue.
Oh, there you go. There's the cameras. I was just kidding.
Oh, smooth.
I found a dog training
3 weeks.
That's it. Let's get together. Council initiated action.
Yeah. Wait. Hold on. That doesn't. That there's no ethics involved here,
right? Anything about that business, I have to abstain. And I don't even know how that would work. Like, when I come up with a demo permit down there, do I have to abstain from that?
Yep. I mean, if it's something that's going to benefit your business, if it's just like a personal permit or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
They have a board meeting and I'm hoping to